You can't deny when you hear the masterful sounds of John Coltrane on tenor sax, taking the lead here and setting the pace on Blue Train, the title track of his 1957 album. He was in his prime then at the Five Spot Cafe, a legendary jazz mecca at Cooper Square in the Bowery section of Manhattan at the time. His sidemen on this particular tune include Lee Morgan on trumpet, Curtis Fuller on trombone, Kenny Drew on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Philly Joe Jones on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, July the 16th, and a really incredible program for you today. I hope you will find value in it. Because we are going to be turning to a major case that basically rattled the nerve in the city of New York, but well beyond its borders. It was a case of a brutal attack and sexual assault, a rape of a woman jogger. She was jogging through Central Park and was brutally attacked. And there was a hue and cry, as there ought to have been, because the crime was just so vicious. But what happened in the furor, because this also was occurring in the context of very, very high racial tensions in the city of New York, there was a demand because it was known or came to be known that the attackers were men of color, young teenagers, males of color, Latinos and African Americans. And there was this insistence that something be done, that the attackers be found immediately and that they would be punished severely. And it's coming, this case is occurring in the aftermath of the explosive case involving the brutal rape and sexual assault and physical assault of Tawana Brawley. And so we had this climate occurring, and then comes the police canvassing the area and just, you know, taking young men in by the untold numbers. We don't even know how many were just taken off the streets and so forth, but a trial ensued, and then we had these so-called convictions And then, of course, we learned that there was a lot that went wrong here in this trial, and that these convictions were very fraudulently obtained. And why? We still don't know why. But we do know that the city of New York has announced that it would settle with five men. Originally, there were seven teenagers who were arrested and brought to trial, along with the five who were eventually convicted. There was one, the only teenager who was then 17 years old at the time, Michael Briscoe, who was the only defendant to actually successfully call into question the evidence of the prosecution in this case. And there was another defendant who actually was found not to be connected to the crime, so he was not really prosecuted for this crime. But just the same, was arrested and was subjected to all of the indignities that went along with that and the violation of his constitutional rights. All of this to say that in the aftermath of the settlement, and people, of course, are very elated that this has come about and they view this as some modicum of justice. But our guest today says that it is exactly that. It is some justice, but it is not complete justice. And this is what he aims to do. Our guest is fondly called in the community Attorney at War, Alton H. Maddox. He announced the last time he was with us, made the momentous announcement that the community had been waiting for a long time. In fact, I was kind of stunned to hear it myself and very, very happy to know that he is returning to the practice of law. And I guess in a way that is to serve notice that things are not going to be the same in the city of New York. So upon resuming his practice of law, he intends, as a first order of business, to reopen this case, and to reopen this case with the eye toward naming names, identifying where the illegalities and the unconstitutional things happened, who did them, why they did them, when how to see to it that they are punished for it, to identify all of the victims. And when he says all, there are, as I said, untold numbers of people who may not have been in the courtroom, but they certainly were arrested, taken off to the streets, their families disrupted and subjected to incredible stress. There were many, many things that went wrong with this case. And Alton Maddox says that he is going to reopen this case and force a reckoning and force the city and force the criminal justice system to examine this case for all of the things that went wrong and to make sure that the names are attached to these wrongdoings and that it would set a precedent throughout the country. This is a routine matter of people being arrested for crimes, tried for crimes they didn't commit, in some cases doing horrendously long prison terms for crimes that they did not commit. And the system never, ever is made to account for why these things happen. Usually they say, well, you know, we settle on a civil level. We, you know, settle a civil suit, give some money, and then we just call it a day. But in the meantime, these people who have been engaging in these wrongdoings continue to have a life. Sometimes they go on to have an even more lucrative life, a better life. And this is the subject of our discussion today. Alton Maddox has been an institution in the city of New York, with deep roots in political activism and advocacy, and for more than four decades has appointed himself as the People's Attorney General, litigating always pro bono, including in the Central Park case, some of the most contentious cases involving official and prosecutorial misconduct in the history of New York. His spectacular courtroom victories over formidable prosecutors and law enforcement agencies have set many legal precedents, but they also have made him a target for precedent-setting retribution. In 1990, in a precedent-setting act of the New York State Legislature, he was barred from the courtroom. Not disbarred. He has never committed any infraction of the law. He has an impeccable record. And still, this illegal act, done by the then State Attorney General Robert Abrams, and facilitated by the New York State Legislature, the professional association, the Bar Association, had no cause to take any action against him, but this was the route that was taken. But it effectively barred him from practicing his profession since 1990. He is now back. The community is rejoicing. But we want to get to this first order of business today, Alton. You will be talking today about the legal basis for the legal action that you contemplate taking. But I want to welcome you, first and foremost, of course, to Lead Stories. Great to have you with us again today.
Well, I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to be able to elaborate on many of the issues that you just raised. And also, you know, want to be able to say that it is shameful in the city of New York that censorship is still widely practiced, and the people's right to know is being denied as we speak, and that we have to meet on the Internet to really get our point across, because that's how sad things are, you know, in the city of New York. But I want to thank you very much for really structuring this program in such a way that many of us who have no voice otherwise are able to take care of things through your own sacrifices. So I appreciate that you very much, Eutrice.
Oh, you're very welcome. And I appreciate the fact that you're here, as you always have been, available and accessible to the community. And you have not at all relented or shirked your self-appointed duty as attorney, the People's Attorney General. Now, let's get to this case. You are going to, or you're contemplating, litigating this case. What is the thrust of your litigation?
Well, I want to just answer one question that haven't necessarily been asked, but I know it may be in the minds of people, and that is why from 1990 to 2014 was I not heard from in a real significant way. I've been very much active politically and very much active in the community, but not necessarily in the courtroom. And I just like to point out that when I came to New York in 1974, actually, I began to practice law as a poverty lawyer at Harlem Assertion of Rights in Harlem. And one of the things that I knew from my practice, which was actually free because these were free legal services, is that one, most blacks in New York cannot afford legal services, and they certainly couldn't afford the kind of legal services that I could provide, because all of us have a right as attorneys to decide our own individual value. And so I realized that based on what I was capable of doing, that it really outpriced most people in New York. And then I also noticed that there was just such widespread racism in New York and around, that many of these cases really require somebody who really wasn't in private practice. because in private practice, you really have to depend upon people to pay for their services rendered. And I couldn't see people being capable of doing that. And so I'm thankful for this, one, to have the interest in really forming what, you know, is called now a People's Attorney General's Office, and then try to attack some of the major cases in the city, which is basically what I did throughout my career. And, you know, I really did it pro bono, which meant that I had to not only practice law, but I had to then go out and find the funds to finance a law practice. And there were no investors in New York, so I couldn't rely on an investment community to come forward and say, well, we want to invest in our own freedom, because people were prepared to do a lot of things, but they were not prepared to invest in their freedom. So when it got to 1990, you know, after dealing with all these cases, to Warner Brawley, Central Park 7, Al Sharpton, and a host of other cases, Yusef Hawkins, and just a number of cases, I had literally run out of resources, and I suppose I had run out of energy. And so, you know, and I couldn't go back before people asking them to pay for my services, because I didn't think I could get any money from a community that had never shown too much in terms of support. And so this really gave me an opportunity to just do a lot of other things I thought was necessary to teach, to try to educate our community, to try to raise the level of consciousness and things of that nature. And fortunately, 24 years later, I'm still here. And so, and now I see cases that were at the top of my docket now beginning to come to fruition, like the Central Park 7, like the Warner Brawley down in Virginia now. And so, you know, I just said, look, I have not been disbarred, and so it's just simply time to start practicing law again. And so that's just the bottom line, you know. And so when I wasn't practicing law, because really of my own volition, it wasn't because of anybody else, because the rules, the disciplinary rules, are clear in what has to happen before you are disbarred or suspended or disciplined. And so, I mean, you can be a first grade reader of Jack and Jill and know really that, you know, my case did not fit into that at all. And so now I'm back. And so, you know, the first thing that is in on my agenda now is the Central Park 7. Because that was one of the cases I was involved in a real big way. The United African Movement was involved in a real big way. That was a case that actually spawned the Freedom Retreat for Boys and Girls, recognizing that our children need survival skills. That was a case that really spawned the Freedom Party itself, recognizing that our people need a political voice, that we also had to deal with unjust laws that were on the books, and that you had to have some type of political leverage in order to do that. And then, you know, after, you know, Gil made his transition, began to realize how important the media itself was, and so we formed the Friends of Like It Is. And so, you know, there's been a lot of things that we've been doing, and now it's just time to go back in the court and challenge this particular settlement. And I want to make everybody perfect clear to this. We're not trying to take one iota of money away from anybody. That's not what this is about. This is about adequate compensation to everybody. And the thing that has to be understood is that in the law itself, there is a right of action, and then there is a class action. And the class action preempts the right of action when the perpetrators or the aggressors have gone after people as a class. And that's what happened in the Central Park 7 case. They went after black people as a class. They went after Latinos as a class. And so it warrants class relief. You can't have a case in which a police department went after a class of blacks and Latinos. Many of them are unknown to us, and you don't give them access to the courts. You don't give them rules of 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure protection. That's an injustice in itself. So, you know, when lawyers decide what has to happen, they automatically recognize that if this was a class action by the police department directed at blacks and Latinos, then you have to ask for class relief. I mean, you can't go into court and say, well, this is just a Central Park 5. I mean, that don't add up under any set of circumstances. And so that's what we're talking about now. You know, we get short shrifted as a people because we don't understand the law, and those who may have some idea what the law might be are afraid to announce it, and so we always end up shortchanged. And, you know, that hasn't been my practice. That's not the way I practice law. And I think that we are fully entitled to everything that the law provides, and Central Park 7 is no exception.
Now, when you say that this calls for basically tackling the case on the basis of class action, mm-hmm. are you talking now about state court or federal court?
No, well, the case is in federal court now, and there are rules of federal procedure in state court. Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Procedure would be applicable, and, you know, we're not trying to change what has already happened. We're just simply saying that the conduct here was so egregious that to simply award monies to five people is wrong in itself. And that has to be corrected because it denies to an unknown class of people access to the courts.
How do you basically make that case? How do you prove that a class of people actually was targeted?
Well, I think one or two things had to happen. One is if the city denies that did happen, then they might not deny it. I mean, they might just simply say, yes, it did happen. I mean, if they do that, then you simply move forward from there. If they don't do that, then you exercise discovery. You know, you do depositions because they happen to know everybody that they arrested. There were police reports on everybody. And those police reports, this is how the process really works. People may not understand it. The way the process really works is that the NYPD, at the end of the day, transmits all of its reports to the controller's office for potential liability. And the controller's office then set up accounts in each particular person's name. And, you know, and start talking about possibility of false arrest, the possibility of malicious prosecution, the possibility of wrongful conviction. So all of these accounts are set up now. Now Scott Stringer has those accounts. They know what they are. They know what the record is. So, you know, at this particular point, what we're saying is let's activate those accounts. Those accounting entries. Let's activate them and give real people some identity and compensate them for the misbehavior of the New York Police Department, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, and any other law enforcement agency.
Who will these people be, though?
I beg your pardon?
Who will these people be?
Well, that's what I'm in a class action lawsuit. You don't know who all the people are. I mean, that's the reason why it's a class action lawsuit, because what you do, you give notice to everybody, you know, through newspapers or whatever, radio and all of that, that there's a class action being prosecuted, and that in the Harlem area there are people who may have been affected by that class, and therefore they should have a certain amount of time to present themselves.
Okay.
And then you move from there.
So, in other words, the theory is that other than these young men, these specific young men who ended up being ensnared in the trial, per se, mm-hmm. there are unknown numbers of young, at the time, teenagers who mm-hmm. were ensnared
right.
in this investigation at that stage of this crime and mm-hmm. subjected to unconstitutional practices,
mm-hmm.
and that basically, infringed on their rights and their families' rights. They are unknown at this time, but they should be known. And this process, we should have a sense, in this case, we should have a sense of how pervasive was the wrongful investigation of this case in the community. How pervasive was it?
And
what went into, how did the police end up with these young men in particular? What was the process that yielded them as the key defendants in the case, but the others who might have been ensnared but did not make the cut as the prosecution and the investigative arms of the case began in the beginning to identify these others as being key, but we'll select these people and prosecute them. But others also have been subjected to unconstitutional practices.
Yeah, right, because first of all, anybody that will take it down to the precinct has a case for wrongful arrest right from the beginning. And then we go from there. So everybody who has been ensnared has a particular right of action. The question becomes how many rights of actions has that person accrued to that person. And so that's part of that process. Now, on the other hand, what you have is once you understand the nature of the wrong and the breadth of the wrong, and then you want to then talk about how do we provide compensation, then people can look at other ways of trying to make sure that it never happened again. For example, here now, there is some need for a legal institution like a law school where you are train blacks and Latinos to become lawyers, and they will become interested in public interest law. I mean, that's one thing you could look at. You can look at the idea that you have a situation where, how did the community really get informed about this, and how was the community mobilized, and whether there's some real place of assembly that the community might need as a standard point, just in case this particular matter recurs again. So there's a number of ways that you can look at how do you prevent the harm again, and how do you empower the community against these kinds of injustices.
I want to come to the question of official misconduct here. How does that get incorporated in the litigation that you're contemplating?
Well, what happens is, obviously, the way it gets incorporated is the fact that, one, all of the actual defendants that we know of have been named. I mean, because, sometimes you can have some lawyers who were never involved in the case from the beginning, who were never involved in the trial itself, and now may have to act on hearsay. Now, a person who acts on hearsay does not draft the kind of complaint that a person who has personal knowledge of, many of us a few of us who were there from the beginning, might be able to really, based on our own personal knowledge, know where this official conduct was coming from, even though in a court of law, we would have to do the discovery if it is necessary in order to state our case. But right from the beginning, I mean, you have to know, for example, that, Ed Koch, Dave Dinkins, Robert Morgenthau, I mean, you have to know all those people were actually right there at the top of the heap. And so, you have to make sure that they are named, and then you have to make sure that other people are named, and even make sure that people are named like Donald Trump, where you invoke pendant jurisdiction, in order to deal with, his allegations. So, there's a number of things have to be developed, but you don't rush from, no evidence and no information and no discovery to hush money. I mean, you just don't do that. And that's what that's what's going on here. And nobody's coming forward to the community and saying, hey, you know, we have something bigger than this. And I think what we have to realize is that those seven young men were not the only aggrieved parties. I mean, so even if you take a very narrow view of who should be compensated, you know, you have to consider the fact that Robert Burns, for example, was disbarred and died as a result of a heart attack. You know, you have to take into consideration that Colin Moore was another attorney, and he was also disciplined, incurred a stroke, and et cetera, and after maybe more than two decades, and now found able to practice law again. Then you have to consider me, who was basically just barred from the courtroom. So now you're looking at another different area, whether there's a chilling effect on the right of counsel, whether they are, whether this was so engineered as to make it virtually impossible for anybody to receive counsel in these cases, and also afterwards to receive competent and zealous counsel in other cases. What was the message that the city was sending? What was the message that the state was sending, you know, in this area? So there's a whole lot of issues that haven't even been discussed yet.
So basically, I mean, just basically drawing from what it is we're talking about here, we are getting the sense that I'm laying out some of the premises that might be included or that you would be tackling. One, there were many more men, young men, who were affected, directly affected negatively than we know. These specific young men who actually were tried were a part of it, but they were not the only people who were subjected to wrongful action by the police, by the prosecution, and even possibly by, you know, the public officials at the time. You mentioned Ed Koch. Ed Koch had basically made some of the most outrageous statements and pretty much convicted these young men in the eyes of, in the court of public opinion. You mentioned Donald Trump making egregious statements, even calling for the death penalty and so forth. You talked about the fact that the attorneys and the several of them, four of the attorneys, ended up being the targets of retribution and discipline in this case. That also is an aspect of the case that says that when you go against a system for African-American attorneys or Latino attorneys, if you go against a system, be prepared that it's going to come after you. One way or the other is going to get you. And you talked about that. And we're talking now about what is the responsibility. It seems that there was a missing responsibility here by some public oversight entity that should have said automatically, this case, for all kinds of reasons, deserves very close scrutiny. And considering that there eventually were exonerations in this case, these young men were found to have been wrongfully convicted and arrested and so forth, that this should automatically have kicked in some kind of review, but that hasn't happened. Is that also a basis for action?
Well, there's no question about it because, you know, I mean, you got 62 district attorneys in the state, but all of them are subject or should be subject to one, the New York State Attorney General, and then after that, the governor of the state of New York. So the buck stops somewhere other than in a local district attorney's office. So, you know, obviously there were abuses that the other person should have known. That should have been curtailed from the beginning. I mean, this is not a case where you need, quote, Charles Hamilton Houston, you know, to realize that there are some constitutional violations here. I mean, people with less of stature than him could see that, and nobody did.
So, if you were to sue on these grounds, what would be the remedy, considering that the case is now long past tried, it's his history, what would be the remedy in or the point of making this claim?
Well, I think there are a number of things in that, and that's a good question. One is obviously the remedies are more than just money, although money would be a factor. And as I said before, I think the number of people that have been aggrieved would expand the financial obligations of New York City, because in addition to the class that we talked about, in addition to the attorneys that we talked about, you know, we haven't talked about the parents yet and the harm that they suffered. Many of them, some of them died, you know, in the process. So, you know, all of that would be considerable concerns. But the other thing that we also have to ask ourselves, are we just talking about paying somebody some money and then happening again and again and again? And that's what you have seen in New York City, where you saw, for example, in highly profile cases, the case of Abner Lima, who got compensation, and then after that he was followed by Amadou Diallo, who got compensation, and then he was followed by Sean Bell, who got compensation, and then the sister Diallo got compensation. So, you know, this conversation just keep going on and on and on. And the president got to ask themselves, well, somewhere we got to stop all this and deal with the problem. And the problem here is well-documented reports, one that came out in 1991, for example, and had been commissioned by Chief Judge Saul Wadler, where it said that New York is infested with judicial racism. Is infested. I mean, that's the word that they use. That's very strong language. And yet, after that, not one black selected official, and certainly no white official, raised any concern about that case at all. Not one. I mean, you can quote me with every elected official in this city, and not one said a mumbling word about that. Now, last week, you just had a Huffington Post just reported a study by the Vera Institute for Justice, which got even more specific, and it said that the Manhattan District Attorney's Office was rampant with racism. Now, in light of those findings, well-documented as they are, I mean, one or two things might happen. The government might say, well, we're going to have a grand jury to investigate the whole judicial system from top to bottom, and we're going to see where that leads. You know, then on the other hand, you know, you have to say, well, if he doesn't do that and you know, you left to your own means and devices, then you at least got to say in a stipulation that you have to be agreed to be enjoined from engaging in any future acts of violation of the Constitution or any acts that promote racism. I mean, you have to at least say that, and that's what we are saying here. That nothing like that has even been brought up. I mean, it's just a matter of taking money and running. And that's just not going to do. That's not going to solve the problem. We have a real serious problem in New York. And even we have these blue ribbon commissions who have given us these reports. You have lived here. I've lived here. We know this. I mean, firsthand. And so obviously the courts could take judicial notice of this themselves, that racism is running widespread in this city and state, and it is costing taxpayers large sums of money. And it will continue to cost taxpayers large sums of money until like-minded and good-willed people sit down and draft a plan to end it once and for all.
Potentially, what kind of legislation could come out of the litigation that you are contemplating?
Well, I think, you know, obviously, you know, you're really talking about what I read in legislature called omnibus legislation, because you really got so many different areas of the law that seem to have been written by racists and put in the books, and now you have to go back through you know, the whole penal code and penal statutes and the criminal procedure law and procedures to really correct that. But, you know, that really has to come under the name of omnibus legislation. And, you know, what happens is a lot of times the state has a procedure for that by the issuance of a so-called grand jury report, which Robert Abrams, of course, abused in the DeWanna Brawley case, but when probably dealt with, you know, it calls for a legislative recommendation for the legislature to take immediate action on. So, I mean, there's a number of things that people can look at to try to find out the best solution to the problem. But no doubt we do have a problem.
Could you give an example of what some legislation might be that would address the question that we're talking about here?
Well, you know, one thing, you know, and we've heard this so often, you know, we talk about personal knowledge. I actually was an attorney during the pretrial hearings. And so the issue of probable cause arose, and the question of whether those statements were made in violation of probable cause in the Fourth Amendment. And I recall asking the lead police officer on the witness stand, when you saw these young men, I mean, describe the conduct that they were engaged in before you stopped them. And he said, well, they were not engaging in any criminal conduct. And I said, what was your basis for doing that? And this is in the transcript now, you know. And he said, well, the reason we stopped them because it was too large of a group together. And I said, well, is that a crime? He said, well, in New York it is. And so we seized them on that, and that's why we took them down to the precinct. Well, that's crazy. I mean, 8 or 10 people, I mean, that's going back to the slave codes. You know, where three of us would assemble and it was automatically a conspiracy that was afoot. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we should have left 400 years ago, and we're still living with it today. And by the way, that's what's called New York law, stop questioning and frisk, and that's on the penal law section 14050, which is still good law in New York. It's still on the books. It can be exercised at any time, and the promise of de Blasio that it may not be exercised again is just not what we need. We need to bring an end to all of that. You have the elected officials saying, well, you know, we see a problem with taking statements, and we think there's something wrong with that. And we think that from the time that a young man comes into the precinct until he leaves, one way or the other, that everything needs to be taken. Well, that's what they said. But, you know, after that, would there have been no legislation to that effect? I mean, so, you know, black and Latino elected officials, along with everybody else, have done absolutely nothing. And that's the reason why, you know, somebody like me has to get involved, because the people that we are paying are doing zero, other than trying to create criticism for those of us who want to try to resolve this problem forever. And, you know, I've invited some black officials over to the forum tonight. We're meeting tonight in a town hall meeting. And I want to see if they're going to be there or not. You know, because, you know, at some point, you got to do your job. I mean, other people can't risk their own lives and careers just to do your job. And that's what is being required in New York.
What would you say, I mean, you've identified several of the key issues. What does this case signify to you, based on all of your experience in the courtroom? What does this case signify to you?
Well, I think the one thing, what it really signifies is the lack of preparation for a confrontation with the police department. I mean, you know, it's like putting David against Goliath. Of course, you know, in this scenario, David doesn't win. But you know, it's you know, you got to even things up right from the beginning. Anytime you have police confrontations, you got to say, well, hey, we got to even this up. You know, you know when you have young people that don't have any survival skills, they don't have any knowledge of how they to be conducted among themselves. When you have parents who are invited to the precinct, who only makes the problem worse, you know, as it happened in this particular case, you know, you have to really look at why is there really a need in an adversarial system to place so much emphasis in extracting confessions out of a defendant. You know, I mean, what's the point? I mean, if this is an adversarial system and you have the Fourth Amendment, which talks about probable cause and all those kind of things. What's the point of lowering the playing field so that the police can have an unfair advantage over the people?
Mm-hmm. And to your mind, if elected officials were to respond to, let's say, to the forum that you're having tonight, what would be their charge?
Well, I mean, we wouldn't want to say we're going to charge them anything. We just hope that we want to scare them away by charging them with anything. I mean, I got a series of items I would charge them with, but I would hope that they wouldn't be afraid. They would just simply come and, you know, and lay, put the cards on the table. I mean, so I don't want to, you know, really answer that question, because some people say, well, hey, I'm not getting ready to incriminate myself openly, at least anyway.
So what would you expect them to do? What would be the legislative, the orders that you would expect them to execute in the state legislature or the city council?
Well, I think one thing that what they would do, it would be if to come forward and say, look, this is the legislation that I have. I've already written this. You know, I think this is meets the honorable legislation test. You know, and now we need to try to see whether this is sufficient, and if it's not sufficient, we need to try to add on to it and then go ahead and get this issue resolved, at least legislatively, and then hopefully, you know, we can resolve this judicially and executively, because, you know, you're still dealing with three branches of government. So, you know, but I would hope that the legislature would be able to say, well, this is our part, and we just got to make sure we get this done, and then we try to make sure we clean up the other acts as well.
Let's talk about the police, because this is the common thread here in this case. It all starts with the police. So many efforts have been made to let the police know that they have to do something dramatically different in the way they conduct themselves within the African-American and Latino communities, but across the board. But they do seem to have a consciousness that they ought to behave differently in white communities as opposed to black and Latino communities.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that, you know, you and I worked on several years ago with Howard Beach, and what really brought about, in my estimation, the death of Michael Griffin were the stereotypes of law enforcement officials. Because actually, you know, what wasn't said here is that the corner officer led the posse. I mean, it wasn't like the posse leading the court officer. You know, the court officer led the posse. I mean, Michael Griffin was murdered by a court officer in a vehicle. You know, I mean, it's just no question about that, you know. And, you know, whether, you know, he wanted to claim accidental or intentional or whatever, I don't know. You know, but I do know that that vehicle had a direct effect on his living or dying, and he died. And so, you know, and then the question becomes, well, what prompted you, you know, after having seen a white mob chasing three young blacks out of Howard Beach, what prompted you to get in charge of that posse? And so, you know, it seems to me to suggest that we're really talking about racial stereotypes and one of the unhidden vices of law enforcement.
Did the attorneys, or have the attorneys in this case, representing the five who have been wrongfully convicted, did they miss a moment here? Have they really missed an opportunity here to make a difference?
Well, you know, the one thing I said all along is this. It's very few lawyers in New York who would even think about really going after Robert Morgenthau. I mean, that's off the table. I mean, and so, you know, when lawyers are put in a situation, you know, where they're supposed to be suing the city and the state and other agencies of government, I mean, you're putting them in a situation where they have to compromise themselves right from the beginning. Because how many people really want to lose their license to practice law over the representation of a black or Latino youth? And, you know, and obviously from nil to none, I mean, in reality. So, you know, really, when you talk about going after a Robert Morgenthau, I mean, that's an institution that would probably frighten virtually every lawyer in the state of New York.
So, did they miss the opportunity?
Well, you know, like I said before, I mean, the point I want to make is, I don't think that was the choice was clear, whether the opportunity was pursued or not. The choice was to just, you know, try to compromise as we are doing and put this behind us and move on.
Could you talk about what you're talking about tonight in this town hall meeting?
Well, you know, one thing, obviously, you know, I have put out a series of publications I've been writing lately, and I think the one, the entire rationale for a settlement agreement, the basic rationale, one that you never hear people talk about, but it must guide any settlement. And that is, you must be just, J-U-S-T, before you're generous. Now, what that means is that all of the elements of justice must be present before you start talking about compensating anybody. So you have to look at a settlement and start off by saying, are all of the elements of justice in present in this settlement? Now, like, for example, here you have the State of Israel today, bombing the daylights out of the Palestinians over seemingly the issue of three Israeli boys being found dead. Now, what's interesting about that case is that the Israelis, like the whites in this country, don't start out with hush money. In fact, hush money is not even part of the settlement. They start out with retribution. I mean, because when the city of New York went after all of the blacks, untold persons in Harlem and the environs, that was retribution. I mean, the idea that a white woman had been raped, the first thing you start off with retribution. In Israel, the idea that three Israeli boys were killed, you start out with retribution. Now, on the other hand, it's funny for us as black people to start out with hush money. I mean, you know, that shows you the disparity between us and other people. You know, we're talking about chicken strike or crumbs, and they're talking about retribution first. We don't know what they're going to get in terms of compensation later, but it starts with retribution. Well, we got to start with something other than hush money. That's my point, you know, because we clearly are not in the 21st century starting off with hush money.
Well, Alton, I want to thank you again for being with us today. And we are going to be monitoring this. This is going to be a very, very serious piece of litigation. And it will reopen this case with an eye toward justice and accountability. And this is a very necessary aspect because it is beyond the case. It actually speaks to a body of experience, and it speaks to what needs to happen to stop the continued pattern that has been established for so many years. So I want to thank you so much for bringing this to our attention. Again, I'm delighted that you're back in the courtroom, and I hope that there would be a difference, of course, being felt because of your presence again in the courtroom. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Etrice, can I get 60 seconds real quick? I'd like to invite everybody who can't come out tonight to be out Saturday, and if you can't come out Saturday, be at an event on my behalf next Tuesday at the Cotton Club. And if you are able to come out tonight, to bring a road atlas with you of the Confederate States of America, because in addition to the topic that we just finished discussing, we will be talking about the Underground Railroad, and the road atlas is very important for that discussion.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you,
Alton Maddox, attorney at war and the people's attorney general, with us talking about an effort to reopen or revisit this case, the Central Park jogger case. This is a huge, huge effort because it speaks to the relationship between the community and the apparatus of government, in this case, a criminal justice system, the police department, and even the judicial system. And what really is justice, where we have this wrongdoing committed? They agreed and they admit that it was wrongdoing, and yet no one is accountable. Life just goes on. You throw a little bit of money at people and you think, well, that solves the problem. That absolves us from responsibility and blame. But of course, it does not solve the structural problem, and it doesn't even address it. And this perhaps would be a way of making sure that we understand the nature of the system that people get ensnared in very often, and that is why we see so many, more than 2 million people incarcerated in the United States, many, many, many of them wrongfully convicted. I want to thank you so much for being with me today. I hope this program in some way brings to your attention a different aspect of what we know as life. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus. Write me a note to let me know how these programs are resonating with you. LeadStories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Thank you so much. A pleasure and a privilege to be in your company.